Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Brittany Mangelson, and I'm really excited about this interview. We are going to be talking about a topic that is well loved by Community of Christ and by seekers alike. We are going to be talking about hymns over the history of the reorganization, the RLDS Church, Community of Christ. I'm really, really excited. So if you enjoy singing hymns, if you care about hymns, we are going to be talking today with someone who really knows what they're talking about. We're going to be talking with Richard or Dick Clothier, and he is in Lamoni, Iowa, and has done a lot of research into the history of the hymns in the church. First of all, Dick, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, what your occupation has been, etc.
Hi, Brittany. I was actually born into a church family in Western Iowa, one of the hotbeds of the reorganization. And when I was only about 3 years old, my family decided to gather to Independence. And so I grew up in Independence. And of course, I went to Graceland like everybody did in those days. And there I met my wife, Luita, also a musician. In fact, I sat behind her in the Graceland Orchestra, and we met that way. I didn't ask her out for a date until the last day of her senior year because I thought it was not good for college people to date high school students. Anyway, we finally married, and we returned to actually join the music faculty at Graceland 5 years later. I was young for my age in those days. I ended up conducting the orchestra, heading the music department, the whole fine arts division, and also the new Shaw Center when it was completed. And we retired 23 years ago after 40 years of service, but we're still here. And we live across the lake from the campus. We watch it every day.
I love that. I love that that's where you started your relationship and met each other and that you're still there today. That's really beautiful. And what a beautiful view to live that close to Graceland.
Oh, yeah. I should take the camera out the window and show you.
It's a really, really beautiful area. So, Dick, what has your involvement been with Community of Christ?
Well, it was pretty total, really. Dad was pastor at one of the Independence churches or another during most of my young life, in addition to working on a part-time farm and had a normal job, too. And so we grew up going to the church every time the building was open, practically. So I've always been active in the Community of Christ. I served over the years as assistant pastor for several years, both in Independence and here. I was worship commissioner at Lamoni. And nowadays, however, without an orchestra to conduct, my only musical involvement really is taking my turn on the wonderful pipe organ at Lamoni Community of Christ.
It sounds like you have a very rich history with the church and that you continue to serve it in the ways that you can. So I'm now wondering, when did you become interested in the history of Community of Christ hymns?
Well, hymns have always been one of my loves. I started taking piano lessons at 5 years old, and I played for the junior church at Spring Branch Congregation, and they suffered all the wrong notes and so forth. And then I started upstairs, and then later playing for services. But all my life, really, I've been active in the hymns of the church and loved the hymns. I taught a number of music courses during my time at Graceland. Late in my experience at Graceland, we were teaching a church music class. And I inherited that from Harold Neal and passed it on to Jack Ergo, who is doing it now. But we had a unit on hymnody, of course. And we talked about various hymns of various churches, but we didn't have much information about Community of Christ hymns. So I decided to do a little research of my own. Chevelle had written about the hymns of the Gray Hymnal in 56, but by then, of course, we were using hymns of the saints. So I decided to write to all the living Community of Christ hymn authors, about 20 of them, asking for information and testimonies from them about their hymns. Lo and behold, I was surprised. I thought I might get a few back, but I heard from every one of them except one. They had many wonderful responses, some of them very moving, like Naomi Russell, that wrote a hymn about, it's not in the Community of Christ Sings, but her daughter was dying of cancer, and she wrote, "Help us to see the breadth and depth of thine eternity," and some pretty moving stuff. And so I decided that we needed to share some of this information more widely. And Roger Yerington at Herald House agreed. And so my 1995 book, which is no longer in print, regrettably, The Heritage of Hymns, was written and published.
Yes, you've written two books about hymns in the Restoration and Community of Christ. So can you give us an example of some of the things that you found as you were researching for this book?
One that I remember particularly, the late Apostle Jeff Spencer really found his niche as a hymn writer during the 10 years. It actually took 10 years to put together the Hymns of the Saints. And he was a member of the committee. He ended up with, I think, a record number of 11 or 12 hymns in the Hymns of the Saints. He told me about each one of them. Just one of them I could mention is Hymn in Community of Christ Sings 607, "Let us give praise to the God of creation." He said in this hymn that he had attempted to respond to a question often asked of him when he was traveling for the church. The question was, "What does the church believe today?" And he answers this in the hymn, actually, with nine basic beliefs. And if you look through Hymns of the Saints 607, you'll see that these nine precepts that he mentioned, one was restoration, two, the living presence of divine power for the task, three, the sacredness of all things, four, the unity of spirit and element, five, the ongoing search for truth, six, men and women together in ministry, then the role of the church as sin bearer, the power of our heritage, and of course, the experience of the God who calls us into the future. So if you want to look those up, it's really a commentary on what, all the basic beliefs of the church. And then, of course, there's the wonderful Barbara Higdon, who also was a member of the committee. I think that most of these people are gone now, and so I feel really fortunate to have their testimony. I'm disappointed that it's not more easily available, but Barbara wrote in Community of Christ Sings 107, "Creation flows unceasingly out of the timeless mind of God." And she responded with a long commentary about spirit and element, as Jeff Spencer mentioned, the intelligent energy of divine creation, the revealed word proposes enveloping unity of all creation, spirit as well as matter, and a mysterious purpose known only to the Creator. And that's in 107. You can get a lot of inspiration by these hymns, I think.
I absolutely agree. I'm a convert to Community of Christ. And when I was learning about the church, the hymnal, for me, it was Community of Christ Sings. That was the first place that I wanted to go.
Oh, yeah.
Because hymns are important. And I do think that we sing our theology. And I love that you cited the basic beliefs in Hymns of the Saint and then continued that through this relationship with the divine through Barbara Higdon's hymn. So thank you so much. So I'm curious, is this kind of information what led you to research and to lead so many historical hymn festivals for JWHA and MHA? Because I know you've done that.
Actually, since retirement, that's been kind of an occupation for me. It just happened that when I ran out of courses to teach at Graceland, I started on that project. I've taught, I guess, for about 15 years until my Parkinson's led me to stop doing that. I've led a hymn festival at practically every John Whitmer Association meeting and a couple of the Mormon History Association meetings, which are very large and very important. I've always maintained when you study history, you learn what happened. When you study hymnody, you find out what people felt about what happened. and you can actually share a bit of their experience. Anyway, when my first book came out, Oliver Houston, my wonderful colleague and organist at the time, suggested that we organize a Restoration Hymn Festival at Graceland to use our new Cassavant organ and to celebrate what we call the various flavors of Restoration membership represented on the faculty and staff. There were Community of Christ, there was LDS, and there were Restorationists. And it went so well, after a couple of years, the word spread, and lo and behold, I was invited to Mormon History Association festivals, and particularly the John Whitmer Historical Association meetings.
And are there any of those experiences that particularly stand out that you remember?
All of them, of course, are wonderful experiences for me, and they must have been for other people because they kept asking me to do it. One that stands out particularly, one of the first ones, 2003, the Mormon History Association, the large group, met at Kirtland, and we decided to see if we could sing for the final service was in the temple. And we thought we could maybe organize a small choir to sing for that service. I discovered how much the Mormons really loved to sing because we had a large choir of participants in the congregation who volunteered in the conference who volunteered to sing for that closing Sunday worship. It took a little doing because we rehearsed after the conference meetings at 10 o'clock every night, and we met really early on Sunday morning in the temple. What we did was we tried to recreate the music from the original service of dedication in 1836 in the temple, including seating the large choir in all four corners of the temple. I don't know how often that had been done since early days, but it was especially memorable to me because it, with all the pillars there and so forth, it was a challenge to conduct that large choir, but in the four corners, but it was great. And several other experiences there in the temple. One more I might mention. We had a very memorable hymn festival in the auditorium that was televised, actually. It was for Joseph Smith Jr.'s 200th birthday anniversary in December 2005. We had a large volunteer choir. The music office took the names of people. It was supported by the local LDS officials. And I could tell that a lot of the choir was actually LDS because when we started rehearsing Redeemer of Israel, and they have a little different take on the melody, which I kind of like, but we started, and one of the sopranos raised her hand and said, "Can we hear that again?" And of course, it's the most popular hymn, but we had a little different version. So I could tell a lot of them were LDS, but we had a great time doing that.
I love that story. It just warms my heart. Yes, I definitely am aware that there's some tunage differences between some of the common hymns. So that's great. Let's talk about your second book, 50 Years of Song. How did that book come about?
Actually, 150 Years of Song, because it was it was for the sesquicentennial, which is a long way of saying 150 years, Community of Christ. It was in 2010. And historians like Barb Walden and John Hamer and so forth lobbied me for a book. The Herald House wanted to put out some books, especially celebrating that occasion. And I had not written about the hymnals of the church through the years, so I decided to go ahead and do it. I told Barbara it was a cold winter, and so I stayed at the task and got it done. And that's the one that's still in print. Yeah, I think you can still get it. 150 Years of Song. It goes through all the hymnals of the church, and I tried to make it as interesting as I could.
Well, I will say it definitely was interesting. I was able to get my hands on a copy before this interview, and I read it. And it was really beautiful and meaningful, but also entertaining. You did well. You did very well. And yes, I did know 150 years. I'm one of those folks that just still thinks that the 1980s were 20 years ago, and they definitely weren't. So
long time ago.
Yes. So can you share a little bit about the various hymnals that Community of Christ, the RLDS Church, that we have published throughout the years?
Yeah, some of the interesting experiences for me were with the very first hymnal of the church before there were LDS and RLDS and so forth. Emma's very first hymnal, and most of us, I think, realize and remember that Section 24, at least the Community of Christ Section 24, the Doctrine and Covenants, it was about 3 months after the organization, and he not only asks but commands his wife to put together a new hymnal, the first hymnal for the church. It took several years because she was busy raising kids and moving around and so forth. But shortly after that, a very important convert to the church, William Wines Phelps, read the Book of Mormon soon after it was published first, and he decided to move his family to Kirtland and get to know Joseph Smith. Well, very soon, Joseph, of course, delivered a revelation to him that he needed to be baptized and ordained an elder and had any penance with. This is the way things happened in those days, to be a printer for the church. He'd had a background in journalism. And so he really helped a lot in getting things going. He's established a print shop south of the square on Liberty Street in Independence. A lot of you will know that. And not there anymore, of course. For just over a year, he was publishing a periodical called The Morning and the Evening Star. It started in 1832, and what he did was he had been so engaged in collecting and correcting hymns. He'd been asked to collect and correct, which meant to change them and so they'd fit the local LDS philosophy and theology. He started issuing in, there are six of them in the first issue and probably three or four in almost all the monthly issues of the Morning and Evening Star. So he actually printed hymns that he'd been collecting in there. And some of them, a lot of them, in fact, were actually adaptations of existing hymns. For example, the very first issue had this hymn that was based on Joseph Swain's poetry. If I read the original poetry to you, you'll probably realize what hymn it is. It says, O thou in whose presence my soul takes delight, on whom in affliction I call, my comfort by day and my song in the night, my hope, my salvation, my all. And that, of course, became, in Phelps' hands, Redeemer of Israel. You got it, right?
Yep. I was just unmuting myself to say that.
So, and that became really one of the battle hymns of the church. There was one verse nobody sings anymore. It was the last verse said, this is Phelps writing, the secret of heaven, the mystery below that many have sought for so long. We know that we know, for the Spirit of Christ tells his servants they cannot be wrong. A lot of the hymns, actually 40 of the 90 hymns in the first hymnal, most of them were adapted or originally written by W.W. Phelps. The one he wrote all by himself was another famous one. And of course, it was the Spirit of God like a fire is burning, probably one of the battle hymns of the church. And that, of course, was written. And as the last hymn to be put in the very first hymnal, it had to be squeezed in with small type. I think you can still buy these replicas of that Emma's first hymnal, just a little pocket-sized thing. But that was written in response to the really Pentecostal experiences that they had leading up to the dedication of the temple. And he wrote that the Spirit of God like a fire is burning. And they actually referred to some of the meetings. They felt that fire in their bones, and they felt that. And so he responded. This is one of the famous hymns of the church. We have, of course, in the Community of Christ, have altered the third verse by referring to the lion and the lamb. And that's one that is we didn't like the way it was written. So it's much better, I think, that it's been corrected by Community of Christ.
I absolutely agree. I don't know if I mentioned this or if you knew this, Dick, but I grew up LDS. And so being a convert to Community of Christ, that was one of the first differences that I noticed because I knew that both churches had that hymn. Mm-hmm. And I was very happy to see the rewrite of Community of Christ. I think that it is much more representative of creating Zion here and now and living in peace among one another and with our neighbors, and is much more applicable to the mission of Community of Christ the way that it was rewritten. So I'm glad that you mentioned that.
Yeah, that's Randall Pratt and Andrew Bolton. They wanted to include the lion and lamb, actually. It's on the church seal, of course. But the original version talked about, I can't remember exactly, but it's something that we don't really worry about much anymore. Interestingly enough, several years ago, I was at Nauvoo for the celebration that they have every year of the burial. It's in the spring. And there's a large contingent of both Community of Christ and LDS there. And they start singing from memory, Spirit of God. And when we got to that third stanza, everybody was looking at one another, what is this? It was very embarrassing, really. It was not much unity involved that day.
Oh, that makes me giggle. But there are real theological implications. I mean, the words that we sing matter. And so the fact that, yeah, there wasn't quite harmony on that verse does not surprise me, and also makes me chuckle a little.
Another thing that's interesting to me is after the first hymn was published, and it's actually 1836, just in time for the dedication of the temple, although it says 1835, Emma was asked to get to work on another one because those 90 hymns were not enough. So in Nauvoo, finally, she came out with another hymnal. It was 1841. It had 300 and some hymns. Soon after the dedication, the Apostles Pratt, Taylor, and Young were assigned to England, and they wrote back to Joseph and said, we really need a hymnal over here. There were only about 1,000 of those first hymnals published, and really were taken up pretty quickly in Kirtland. So they had no hymnals in England with the mission, and so they wanted to see if they could publish one on their own. Well, Joseph, reportedly anyway, wrote back to them and said, well, Emma's working on a new one here in Nauvoo. Just be patient. It'll come out soon. And evidently they didn't get the letter, or they chose not to worry about it, because they went ahead and put a hymnal together anyway on their own. And Parley P. Pratt was one of the chief authors in that. And those hymns, we call it the Manchester Hymnal in 1840, because it was published in Manchester, England. Those hymns are a little more distinctive, like, and some of them are still used, like Pope's verse, if you could hide the Colob, you remember that one? If you could hide the Colob, and see, I don't remember what it goes. Michael Hicks, who's an LDS historian on hymns of the church there, calls it text relating to the expanding theology of Joseph's last years. I think Community of Christ would agree that his theology really expanded in his last years. But the important thing, I think, is the LDS hymnals flow from that time, because all three of those apostles went west and through some 27 or so revisions into the current year. It's a very distinctive hymnal. If you look at both the hymnals together, the Community of Christ and LDS hymns are very, very different. Hymnals are very different. Emma's Nauvoo hymnal, 1841, had more mainstream hymns, like Amazing Grace, and one of the hymns that's been called the best one in the English language, When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. And so all of our Community of Christ hymns flow from that hymnal, because she was asked also to do a hymnal for the reorganization, and it was printed in 1861, but it's very close to the Nauvoo hymnal, almost a rewrite of that. So our hymnals today, if you compare them, are very, very different.
They really are. And I think it's interesting. Rumor has it the LDS Church is working on a new hymnal. And I'm curious to see if those hymns, like If You Could Hide to Colob, end up in the new hymnal. Because even my generation, that was kind of out there. theology. And I think people younger than me are even more detached from it. So I do, just to reiterate what you're saying, you can really see the progression of Community of Christ and of the LDS Church in the hymnals. And yeah, it's important. Hymnody is extremely important to the culture and theology of a denomination.
I like to say we sing what we believe and we believe what we sing. Sidelight for a moment. Tomorrow's Valentine's Day. We can say, I love you. But if we sing a love song, it's much more important. It's much more emotional. It involves the feeling as well as just the words. I like to refer to the Apostle Paul, who said, I will pray with the spirit and I will pray with the mind also. I will sing with the spirit and I will sing with the mind also. He would pray with his mind and with his spirit. And it's important that we have both.
Absolutely. Yeah. Its importance cannot be overstated, I think. So thank you for that. Okay. So you just mentioned that Emma did a hymnal for the reorganization, and that was patterned closely after the Nauvoo hymnal. What's next?
The Plano Lamoni period, Plano-Lamoni. Mark Forskett was a British convert to the church. His life is so interesting, but I've often said his life would make a good movie. He was kicked out of the house in God Manchester, England, by his parents because he converted to the LDS Church. And he had a place at Cambridge University. He was very brilliant, but somebody told him that you don't need an education. God will give you everything you need to say. So he didn't take his place at Cambridge, but he became so converted that he decided that on his wedding day, 1860, he sailed with his wife to America. He pushed a handcart to Utah, became a private secretary to Brigham Young, but he was so disillusioned with what was going on there, he eventually ended up back in the Midwest as a good friend of Joseph III. He was a very important and talented preacher. He was also one of the Graceland administrators in the early days. He prayed at the dedication of Graceland. And comments say, Brother Forskett prayed. Oh, how he prayed. He decided to put together, from all of his notes, the number of hymns that he collected from Britain, from Utah, and elsewhere. And the words only, the collection in the hymnal amounted to 1,120 hymns, if you can imagine. Now, the present hymnal, Community of Christ Sings, as the largest since then, 664 hymns. If you imagine almost duplicating that and try to get it into small size, it was amazing. People say, well, that's great, but we should have music with it. So he got to work on that. And in 1889, he published a really huge, 8.5 by 11 by about 1.5 inches thick. It was the Saints Harmony, 1889, published in Lamoni with music for all the 1,120 hymns from the harp. And if we had video, I could show you the book. It's the one with split pages. The melody, the music, and the text are on different parts of the page. You can mix and match. You'd think it was very well accepted, but actually it wasn't because it was too big, it was too expensive. I think he charged a couple of dollars instead of 50 cents that they were used to paying for hymnals. And the conference then in 1895 took specific action. They wanted a smaller hymnal with no more than 200 hymns, plus 50 sets of words in the back. And they said it was to put together by music leaders. To be cost only 50 cents and be called the Saints Hymnal, and they even named the new committee, and Forskett was not included. I imagine it must have been a big shock for him. It was his life's work to put that together, and it was a failure, and he was not even appointed to the committee again. That's pretty much the Lamoni story, although in 1903, the Zion's Praises was published in Lamoni, and it had more lively songs for the Sunday school movement, but everybody else enjoyed them too. And there were also new hymns that had been written, like the Old Path, and some hymns by Joseph III, who actually wrote a number of hymns himself. And that was published at Herald House in Lamoni. So that's the Lamoni story, and I'm sticking to it.
I have to say that it would be so sad to not be on the new committee after you had arguably done a over the top job for what,
yeah,
for the hymnal. I mean, he almost did it a little too well.
That's right.
But yeah, that is fascinating. So that takes us through the Lamoni period. And what's next?
Well, then everything moves to independence, of course, the headquarters of the church. And at that point, there are two hymnals in current use, the Zion's Praises, 1903, and then the adaptation of Mark Forster's work, the 200 hymns plus Saints Hymnal. So they decided the next Saints Hymnal in independence, it was published in 1933, and it combined selections from both the Zion's Praises and the Saints Hymnal. So then after that, of course, we could go really quickly. 1956, Franklin Weddle was the first full-time music director for the church, put what we call the gray hymnal, or just called the hymnal. Some people say it was gray in style as well as color. He wanted more dignity in worship, and he left out all the Zion's Praises hymns and left out all the what we call syncopation in music. So then another committee was formed. Harold Neal took Franklin Weddle's place, and I was actually on that committee until we moved to England. That was Hymns of the Saints, 1981. Again, more variety and inclusive language. We worked on that a long time in the committee, trying to get inclusive language for humans, not for God, but for humans. And it's 10 years getting that put together. The current hymnal, of course, attempted, and I think they did a wonderful job, inclusive language for divinity, which is very difficult. What pronouns do you use there? And they put that together, and it was printed in record time because the committee was only headquarters people. So that's a brief rundown of the 12 hymnals of the church.
So thank you so much for that really good overview. I know that I learned a lot, and to me, it's just so interesting to see the evolution of hymnody in the church. What are some of the similarities and differences that you noticed between the various hymnals?
Well, of course, when you go back and look through, there's many more differences than there are similarities. For example, not many of the early hymnals have texts that we could sing today. You look through the 90 in the little first hymnal, and there are only 7 or 8 from Emma's first collection in today's hymnal. Even a few we do sing contain some phrases that we might leave out if we weren't so popular today, like restoring their judges and all as at first, going back to the early days of the organization. We know he is coming to gather his sheep and plant them in Zion. We don't think that Zion is going to be the destination for all of us. Let's go a little further here. Our theology has changed so much that we no longer insist on being the one true church. We don't believe we have a monopoly on all light and truth. We no longer preach the imminent return and the Zionic reign of Christ with the intended destruction of non-believers. We no longer think of Zion as a specific place in Missouri to which all the saints will repair for safety. And in fact, just for fun, I want to read another hymn by Phelps, which was called There Is a Land the Lord Will Bless. His printing press in Independence was destroyed by a mob after about a year, and the type was scattered in the street. And the next installment of the Morning and Evening Star came from Kirtland. But here's one that once makes the point. It's a revision of an existing hymn, but it says, there is a land the Lord will bless, for all the saints shall come. There is a day for righteousness when Israel gathers home. Before the word goes out, destroy, and all the wicked burn. With songs of everlasting joy, the pure in heart return. And where are they going to return to? The fields along Missouri's flood, in other words, along Missouri River, are in perspective seen as unto Israel, Canaan stood, while Jordan flowed between. I used to say, as we were going to Independence, we'd drive across the Missouri River there, south of Liberty, and we'd say, well, we just crossed the Jordan River, so we're back to Zion now. And he's making that comparison. I think that's a lot of fun. It illustrates some of the differences, really, between the theology and early hymns and the current ones. There are some similarities that continue. we still affirm the importance as well as the practice of the ongoing revelation of divinity. It's in our DNA and it's in our procedures. We count on it happening. We rely on a well-prepared, self-sustaining ministry. We still value the wisdom of the scriptures, and we enjoy a unique sense of community with members throughout the world. And I can testify to that because wherever we go, we run into Community of Christ folks, and it's just like we were home again. They welcome us there. Even in our travels abroad, we felt right at home with church people.
That is one thing that I love about Community of Christ, is the feeling of family and welcome is absolutely consistent wherever you go.
We'd been on the Graceland faculty for 13 years. It was a long time toward retirement. We really loved it at Graceland, and we didn't want to leave. But we decided we would see if we could go somewhere for a year or so, and just for a change. We applied a lot of places, of course, and we both were in the field of music, so it really was not very possible, particularly to go abroad, which we were interested in. But we had a friend who taught at probably the best international school in the world, except perhaps for the one in Japan. It's the one in downtown London, England. We had written and sent our credentials and didn't hear back. All of a sudden, one Friday morning in Lamoni, we got a call from the assistant headmaster. We'd like for you to come and teach for us in London. We couldn't believe it. I mean, it was a miracle, really. Those things just don't happen. But it did. We moved to London. We enjoyed the kids grew up there, and we became a British people really for 6 years. And we had an opportunity to return to Graceland after that. But it was one of the most incredible experiences. It just could not happen, but it did. Both of us in the field of music, I was asked to head up the music department and shape it up a little bit, and later was promoted or demoted, whichever, to assistant principal for the rest of the time. It was an incredible experience. When you talk about miracles, this is one of those that happened in our life. The saints over there are still very dear to us. We went back numerous times while we were still able to travel that way. House sitting for the summer with people that we used to know on the faculty, and just becoming really British people for a long time. And we were so accepted. Dunfield House, we have so many dear friends. We still tune into their live services on Sunday and join with them there on internet via Zoom.
I'm so glad that you shared that story, and I'm so glad that you are able to still connect with them. That was going to be a question of mine, is whether or not today you're still able to communicate and be connected with those folks. And it sounds like you are, which is a miracle in and of itself.
That's right.
This has been such a lovely interview, and we just have a couple more questions to wrap up. We talked about the similarities and differences that you've noticed through the various hymnals. And you've touched on this a little bit, but do you have any more thoughts on how our theology has changed through our hymnody?
It's changed so much that we wouldn't really recognize a lot of the early hymns, and we certainly wouldn't sing them. But there are some that still are dear to us. In terms of believing what we sing, we tend to repeat and to sing words that just become a part of us, and so they become part of our beliefs. And the Community of Christ sings, there are a lot of forward-looking hymns and texts, really, that stretch us a bit. They have included a lot of hymns, and there's a whole new movement by hymn writers, the Hymn Society of America, and they have very talented hymn writers. I think that one of the most talented ones, who's really a wordsmith, passed away a few years ago, Shirley Murray in New Zealand. I think she has a record number of hymns. You can check it. And every time I sing one of those, there's an insight that comes from what she says.
Dick, I'm so grateful for all of the stories that you have shared. As you've been talking, it's reminded me that we've had presiding evangelist Jane Gardner on to talk about the hymnals before, and she has mentioned that we sing our beliefs into being. That might be a paraphrase quote from Jane, but essentially that we start acting and believing, and our values are based on what we sing. So what kinds of things do you see us experiencing and believing in Community of Christ sings? And how do you think hymns have taken us into the future?
There are a number of challenging hymns in Community of Christ sings that are new to us, not only the tunes, but also the texts that seem to challenge us. Some of them were not there yet to really be able to grasp those and incorporate them into our lives. But we do tend to sing what we believe. And then by singing that over and over again, we come to believe what we sing, and it works the other way around too. Hymns are so important to that. They'll teach us, and also they'll express what we feel, as well as teaching us new concepts. I mentioned the effort to use inclusive language for humanity and divinity. And that's something Hymns of the Saints struggled with and didn't really solve the problem of divinity. Community of Christ Sings has done a good job of that. I think it's important that we realize that we need to accept some of the new ideas, try them out, sing them, because by singing, they work their way into our brains. Just like Valentine's Day that says, I love you, and we sing that, and it makes a lot more impact than just saying it.
Absolutely, because that emotion and words are combined to deliver a really powerful message.
I sing with the spirit, and I pray with the spirit, and with the mind also. And that really does have that effect, I think.
Absolutely. Where do you think Community of Christ Sings is taking us?
It's taking us to a new level, I think, of experiencing things from other authors and other composers, both music that challenges us. A lot of them we can't sing without the tape because, unfortunately, we don't have the musicians in a lot of the small congregations to be able to do them. The new modern composers, many of them from outside the church, have stretched us with our thinking. And I think that will carry us into the future really very well.
Dick, I just have to say that this has been such a joy to chat with you this morning. And I always like to end these interviews by just saying, is there anything else? Were there any other stories, any other last minute thoughts that you wanted to make sure that we hear?
Let me just share one final anecdote. When I was putting together the testimonies of the hymn writers from Hymns of the Saints for my first book, I did a lot of them by written material. But here in Lamoni, one of the real great poets of the church and of Graceland was Cleo Moon. By that point in her life, she was in her 90s. I went out to visit her at the local care facility, and I asked her if she could share something about the writing of her hymns. She had several hymns in the Hymns of the Saints, and some of them are still in Community of Christ Sings. And she looked at me, she said, I can't remember writing these anymore. I can't remember anything from back then. She could no longer remember her hymns, remember even writing them. So we sat and read through each one of them together. After each one, she turned to me and said, that's good, isn't it? I said, Cleo, it's very good. And she could no longer remember, but she could evaluate the works that she's done. And after we read through all of them, and she said, and it's something I'll never forget, she said, I'm glad I did it then because I couldn't do it now. And that it's very important to me now, and I'm getting close to the 90s myself. But the Doctrine and Covenants scripture to work while it is yet day, because for many of my people, the night will come when opportunity to assist will have passed. I think that's where we are today, that we need to evaluate where we are and to keep working, because someday we won't be able to do it anymore. I think it's a challenge for all of us.
That's really thoughtful and thought-provoking. And like you said, it's challenging. And when you think about what legacy are we as individuals, or we as a local community or larger world church community, what legacy are we leaving? I think that those are really important questions, and that's really thoughtful advice. So I appreciate it. And I appreciate people who go for it and say yes when they are able to bring ministry and to write things down and to do all the things that ends up becoming their legacy, because that's what we leave others, and that's what we leave our kids and our grandkids. And it's really important. So thank you for that. Thank you.
As a pastor, you recognize the importance of that particularly, I'm sure.
Yeah, I want a community for my kids and grandkids, and one that teaches them that God loves them and that all are called and that they can be part of this larger story and this larger song. And that's really, really good advice.
The reason they know that Jesus loves them is because they sang that song in Sunday school. And that's important, to be able to sing what you believe, and eventually you will become to believe what you sing. That's a good example. Jesus loves me, this I know, because the Bible tells me so. And the music of the song tells me that too. And you remember that. You have a way to remember words that have been set to music. Just like the hymn Admonition that was written over 100 years ago, because it was put to music. Joseph Luff sang it in an experience at the Throne Church prayer meeting. And it was a divine message. But we wouldn't remember it today if it hadn't been set to music. There's other stories like the Old Path and so forth that we can sing from memory. Over 100 years ago, it was written, and we still remember it because it ingrained in our being through music. The inspired texts together with music are incredibly important.
I absolutely agree. And I'll just say really quick that in my congregation, we've recognized that, and we have picked out a handful of hymns that we really want to teach our kids. And we're having the kids do musical numbers. So just yesterday, the kiddos sang All Things Bright and Beautiful, and they worked on that for weeks and weeks, if not even a couple of months, really since the beginning of the year, I think. And so they all know it. And we taught them little hand actions so they could remember the words. And we're going to continue doing that because, like you said, music sticks in your memory a lot better. I remember songs of my childhood. In fact, I could probably sing you the 29 counties of Utah right now because I learned them to song. So absolutely. Music is important. Absolutely. Well, Dick, this has been a delight. And I'm so grateful that you said yes to this interview.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it too, and I appreciate the opportunity to look back on some of these experiences and to share them. I don't get a chance to do that very much.
This has been a really meaningful interview, so thank you.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Project Zion Podcast is a ministry of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.